Hello and welcome to Crosscut Talks, a podcast replay of Crosscut's live interviews with the people who shape our world. I'm Mark Bumgarten, the news and politics editor at Crosscut. Americans are talking about socialism a lot right now. The Democrats running for president have been calling for new and improved social programs like Medicare for All. Meanwhile, conservative politicians are claiming that these ideas undermine our democracy. So, is the Democratic Party truly in the midst of a radical transformation? And what do we really mean by socialism anyway? We brought together three people from Washington State uniquely qualified to answer those questions. Tina Podlodowski is the chair of the State Democratic Party and has been making moves to increase Washington's influence on national Democratic politics. Sarah Smith is seeking to change the party as well. She recently ran for Congress as a Democratic Socialist, but ultimately lost to the Democratic incumbent. Shama Sawan is not a Democrat. She's a leading voice in the Socialist Alternative Party that helped move Seattle to adopt a $15 minimum wage. She's also been a member of the Seattle City Council since 2014. David Plotz is the CEO of Atlas Obscura and co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest. He moderated the conversation. This talk is sponsored by Comcast and the Washington Policy Center. It was recorded on May 4th, 2019 at Seattle University as part of the Crosscut Festival.
Hello. So I saw this wonderful, wonderful in a dismal way, story yesterday in the Financial Times. It was about a gathering that Michael Milken is doing in Beverly Hills with a bunch of extremely rich people to talk about income inequality. And there was a comment from the CEO of Citadel, which is a huge hedge fund, a guy named Ken Griffin, who just bought a $238 million home in New York City, the most expensive home in America, private home in America. And he said, the people who are talking about socialism are people who don't know history. So, Shama, let me start with you. So, when you hear that coming from somebody who's a hedge fund gazillionaire, what is the proper response to that?
I think when a hedge fund gazillionaire, as you said, feels the need to start vilifying the ideas of socialism, you know that the ideas of socialism are starting to take root once again in the United States. And that the billionaire class is on defense because they understand logically, they don't accept the position of socialism from a moral standpoint, but they understand, some of the more intelligent ones anyway, some of them are completely out of touch with reality, but some of the more intelligent ones understand that the inequality in our society is so deep and intense in the richest country in the history of humanity, that they understand that it's inevitable. It is going to have young people start thinking about why should we accept this society and why should we not fight for some other society. But that kind of thinking presents a direct challenge to capitalism, and the capitalist class has no interest in challenging capitalism. So you will hear this kind of naysaying about socialism.
Sarah, you're a member of the Democratic Socialists as well as Democratic Party. Shama, you're a member of a socialist party.
Socialist alternative.
Tina, you are not a member of a socialist party, I don't think. But Sarah, what I was, when I went to school, socialism was taught to me as centralized ownership of the means of production, limited ownership of private property, central planning of the economy. How would you define socialism, democratic socialism, and progressivism, for those of us who haven't paid as much attention to these distinctions as we should have?
So I think socialism, by definition, is exactly what you talked about. It's means of production and public ownership of means of production. And then democratic socialism, it's taking this idea that workers are the primary producers and we are the primary laborers. I mean, no one is a self-made millionaire if they required laborers in order to make their millions. And it's taking that idea and it's saying that these workers who've created this economy, who've created this wealth, deserve a bigger say than they're getting. They deserve a bigger piece of that pie than they're getting. And it always makes me laugh when the billionaire class seem to be the ones criticizing socialism, because socialism is the number one thing that's going to help the working class the most. And democratic socialism wants to empower workers. It wants to empower laborers. It wants to regulate the market and control it and make sure that working people actually have a bigger say in what goes on in their economy. It's not just about a political democracy. It's about an economic democracy as well.
And progressivism is?
Progressivism is leaning into a lot of these formerly socialist policies. Progressivism is recognizing all people deserve a dignified quality of life. All people deserve healthcare. All people deserve education. We deserve robust infrastructure. We deserve good paying jobs. We are a hardworking nation of hardworking people, and we deserve to be compensated accordingly and cared for by one another in our society. And it's about using these policies in order to make sure that that happens. And it's taking these formerly socialist ideas and it's making them accessible to people in a way that's not just couching them under the boogeyman of socialism, which has been used as the monster hiding under our political bed for so long, and it just doesn't have that same kind of acidity to it anymore because these policies are being talked about independent of that label.
So, Tina, as a state party chair, you have the job of helping to harness some of the energy that's coming from the left or the right of your party or the center of it and helping turn that into electoral success and party success.
I think my panelists here, my fellow panelists, have actually just co-opted the fundamental ideas behind democracy and the Democratic Party. I want to read you a quote. Socialism is the scare word that's hurled at every public benefit advance that we've ever made, whether it's public power, Social Security, bank deposit insurance, support for families and family farms, free and independent labor organizations, and I'll add Medicare and Medicaid. That's 1952 Harry Truman avowed Democrat. Now, if you think about what's happened in terms of the Democratic Party itself, the party of Jefferson and Madison, every political party has been skewed by a variety of ideas over time. But to me, fundamentally, the Democratic Party of today is the party of FDR. It is the party of the New Deal. It is the party that is looking to make sure that each and every one of our values is represented. We disagree, and I think we will on this panel, with regard to capitalism in that. Capitalism that's unfettered and unregulated, it does not work for this society in any way, shape, or form. And Democrats have to be true to our values about fighting for that. It is indeed very, very true if you look at free market economics and the work that's been done there. And if you believe in our progressive values, it is of the people, by the people, for the people. Private business depends upon public resources. Nobody in this country goes it alone. So fair taxation is a component of that, and making sure that we are building out from the middle class. I'm a first-generation kid. My mom and dad were immigrants from Poland after World War II, refugees. The reason I'm sitting on this stage today is because they were able to get a job because of a labor union. My dad and my mom were UAW members. I was the first kid in my family to go to college, and we built our middle class. So I would say that the Democratic Party is now moving and is truer to its roots than ever before. And I think hopefully we can all be in agreement that other factors, particularly the Republican Party today, rampant conservatism, rampant and unfettered capitalism, are the woes that are plaguing our country.
Shama, do you think you work explicitly outside of Democratic Party, Republican Party, in a way that Sarah doesn't? I mean, when you hear Tina say that, do you think there's a way for the ideas that you espouse and the policies you want to pursue that they can be channeled through the Democratic Party, which is has a lot more members, is a lot bigger party, gets presidents elected, or can it not work that way?
First of all, the most important fact, paramount fact to recognize is that when you talk about the Democratic Party, you have to be specific about what you mean. Do you mean the Democratic establishment that controls the agenda of the party? Or are you talking about tens of millions of people who self-identify as Democratic Party supporters or as Democrats? And when you set it up like that, you can see the chasm between what ordinary people, the tens of millions of people, including hundreds of thousands in Seattle, want, and what the agenda of the establishment of the Democratic Party is. And if you look at the Democratic Party compared to the Republican Party. Absolutely, I think there is strong agreement that first of all, at this moment, concretely, the most important priority is defeating Trump. There's no question about that, because it's not just Trump, it is defeating the right wing, the bigotry, the anti-worker, anti-immigrant, anti-LGBTQ agenda that Trump's administration represents. But the question is, what is the best way to do that? And that is where I think, when you talk about actual questions of how politically can you defeat the Trump agenda, that you run into the barriers in the Democratic Party establishment. I mean, if you look at West Virginia, for example, West Virginia was a state in which Trump won every county in the general election. But West Virginia is also the state where early last year, you had the most historic and militant labor strike. You know, it was a wildcat strike. They actually, the public school teachers who went on a strike, they actually broke the law to go on strike, and they won phenomenal victories. And they actually ushered in something that many people had not expected at all. It was what they ended up calling the Red State Teacher Rebellion. Many of these states are traditionally considered Republican territory or Trump land, but it is in Trump land that you are seeing some of the most incredible rank and file grassroots labor movement action that is happening. And the teacher strikes in the blue states, actually in the Democrat stronghold states, actually followed these strikes. So I think if you look at it that way, you can understand that the real barrier to defeating Trump, to defeating right-wing ideas, but not only stopping there, but for ordinary people to win the kind of victories that they need to win in order to stop the bottom from falling from under their feet, is to actually build massive grassroots actions against big corporations, against big business. But the problem is that the Democratic Party establishment is so beholden to and married to big corporations and big business that this runs into a contradiction. And so that's why, you know, I would say the problem with the Democratic Party can be, again, demonstrated again concretely with how now powerfully they are going after Bernie Sanders again. I mean, the New York Times has had unusually frank articles where it sort of says that, you know, the Democratic Party establishment's biggest concern is how to defeat Bernie Sanders.
I'd love to hear you. I mean, if you can get away from big business for a minute.
I mean, it's a lot of opinion. It's not a lot of fact, okay, in terms of the work that's being done. Let's look very clearly that the agenda of the Democratic Party across this country is for the people. The agenda for the Democratic Party in Washington State is for the people. If you care about unions, then unionize. We're one of the only two state parties in the entire country that is unionized, that is represented. And we stand with our union brothers and sisters. If you care about the work of the people, then look at what we can do in terms of building up middle class and work through this. Look, our political system, this thing that you try to label in terms of this democratic establishment or whatever, it is a model that no longer works. You want to go back to a Democratic Party that I don't think looked like our party of today. When you're talking about the 50s and the 60s, you look at how people swerved and try to embrace certain ideals after getting stuck with Reagan and getting stuck with Nixon and getting stuck with Bush, who in fact stole the election from Al Gore in 2000 with an assist from a voting system that is unfair and continues to be unfair today. It's the Democratic Party that is fighting those things. I am a state party chair. I'm also a member of the DNC by virtue of being a state party chair. I can tell you that the members of the DNC that come from state parties, state party chairs and vice chairs and elected members, that grassroots now outnumbers by far any appointed members or anyone that might be considered, I guess by that label, a political establishment. And we work together to put together a unity and reform commission to make sure that the process for Democrats running for president is fair. But more so than that, we are building grassroots political power. Look, in Washington State, we came up with a program called Rise and Organize. It's a program that the DNC adopted as a national model. We trained over 7,500 people in Washington State to date, and we're not done yet, in terms of their understanding of how to build electoral power. To me, that's the power of the Democratic Party. That is the party that we will continue to work on and become. And if anything, we should be working together, not at cross purposes.
All right, so I think there's an interesting dilemma that all of you run into, which is that when you look at the particular issues around which you probably all agree, which is universal, I assume, I won't attribute to, but some form of universal access to healthcare, much better childcare, higher minimum wage, better standards for labor, there is huge popular support for any one of those if you poll it. And yet on all of those issues, we are generally going backwards. So in terms of healthcare, we have the continuing assault on Obamacare, which has restricted it. There is no federal national minimum wage hike that's going to come anytime soon. What, Sarah, as a politician, you know, how do you actually translate what is clearly a popular desire and popular will into any sort of effective national policy, given what seems to be the huge constraints in Washington?
I mean, I think we're already seeing it happen. Alex Ocasio-Cortez is a junior representative in her first term. She's a freshman representative, and she is already pitching the Green Deal. She's already keeping Medicare for All front and center, single payer. She's talking about immigration reform. She's already doing it. And as a party, it's wonderful to be able to write things down on an agenda, and it's an entirely different thing to actually stand up for the things that are written in that agenda. Because we right now in Washington controlled the House, the Senate, and the governorship, but we haven't done anything about our deeply unfair taxation system. We are still using the backs of the poor and the working class in order to carry us through as a state. We are still talking about these things that should be no-brainers in the state party and on a national scale. But I mean, as far as translating it into conversation, people want to talk policy now. They want to talk policy. We're tired of living in a post-factual society under Donald Trump. We want to make sure that we're getting to the heart of these policies and how they help people and how they make people's lives better. Teaching people that, you know, single-payer healthcare, it uncouples you from being forced to stay at a job where you get good health care, so you actually have true freedom of mobility in your work. Being able to have childcare that's funded and good quality, both employs people as childcare workers, and also makes sure that people can go to work without worrying about where their kids are. It empowers workers. And when you talk about these policies in such a way that you're actually linking them to real life moments in people's lives, they relate to that. If you can actually take these policies and talk about how they're going to make people's lives better, they want to talk about that. That's cross-aisle politics. That's cross-aisle discussion. I mean, you talk about the Green New Deal, and you can go on and on for how it's going to create good-paying jobs and greenify our economy. We've, as a nation, always been on the forefront of new energy systems, and this is the next venture in energy. This is the new frontier. People get that. They understand it. People are a lot smarter than their politicians are treating them, and we just have to talk to them like they are.
I think the question of unity and collaboration is a serious one, and we should take it seriously. As a matter of fact, no social change has ever been won without building a very strong, unified grassroots struggle in order to win it and, you know, sort of to overcome the forces of opposition. But I think the question that is embedded in when you say, well, we should be working together, absolutely, but with whom and on what? You know, I think that's the question. Look at public school education. I mean, I used to be an adjunct professor here at Seattle University. And at that time, I was also teaching at Seattle Central Community College. And I am one of the many, many, many adjuncts who used to have to, forced to, despite having a PhD, cobble together a living somehow just to be able to pay your rent. There are so many PhD professors who are qualifying for food assistance now because they are being paid so little. Why? Why has that debacle been reached? And in Washington State, for example, let's take the example of Washington State. I think Sarah made a very important point, which is despite having the majorities in both state houses, despite having the governorship, the Democratic Party establishment, the leadership, has not actually listened to what its rank and file Democrats want. And one example of what they want in this state, which is very, very clear, is full funding of public education by taxing big business and closing the corporate tax loopholes. But there is no movement towards that at all. And I don't think we should just be looking at national and state politics, which of course it's absolutely important. But we are in Seattle. Look at what's happening in Seattle. In Seattle, the mayor is a Democrat. All the city council members, 8 of them are Democrats. I'm the only one who's a socialist. And yet, given the stunning and unprecedented homelessness and affordable housing crisis, and despite our movement that my office was a part of, really fighting for an Amazon tax, that is a tax on big businesses, not on the small businesses, the top 3% of big businesses, to be able to fund social housing, that is publicly owned affordable housing and expanding homeless services. Despite us winning a unanimous vote, overcoming the opposition of the corporate politicians, yet less than a month later, these Democrats repealed that Amazon tax. Why? Because they are so, they're so tied into corporate interests. So when the Amazon lobbyist calls and when Jeff Bezos makes open threats, you end up capitulating to his bidding rather than staying with ordinary people. So I think absolutely unity, but what we have demonstrated through my office is that we absolutely have unity, but it's unbending unity with ordinary people who need us to fight for big shifts in society, not unity with the corporate lobbyists. That is the wrong kind of unity.
Nina. Mm-hmm.
I think it's really easy to pontificate and call people's names like establishment. I think it's a hell of a lot harder to legislate and actually get something done. Look, in the Washington State Legislature, until I became state party chair just 2 years ago, we were in the minority in the state Senate. Everything was being stopped. You know, we have gone, and again, in 2018, we have done the work to change that. We put together the most diverse state legislature ever in the history of Washington State. We have gone ahead and made sure that we elected more women, more immigrants, more people of color, more people from the LGBT community, more people who have working class backgrounds and experiences, and it shows. In this session, we passed 485 bills. That is the most productive state legislature since 1993. And this is the work that we've been able to do because we have those majorities. Did we get everything done that we needed to do? No. But if you go back and look at some of these principles, and it's like we're talking about the Green New Deal as though this is a new idea that somebody came up with, and I'm supportive of it. But the reality is the Green New Deal is nothing different than the environmental package that Dow Constantine put together back in 2000 when he was a state legislature. In the state legislature, that's 19 years later in working through this. We have agreement in how we want to make these things become law and do the work and make this happen. So to name call, to say that we're beholden to some corporate interest when the Democratic Party and these legislators are actually doing the work and fixing things doesn't help us fix things. All this does is drive wedges and keep an entire coalition of people apart to do this particular work. And again, when it comes to labor, I don't see anybody up here, but my fellow panelists, besides myself standing with labor. I don't see you when you're there in terms of working with labor. I don't see you when it comes to everything from building trades to UFCW to all the way through. So please, don't pontificate about this stuff unless you're going to go there and do the work and make sure that there is an actual solution, because that's the hard part.
I think this debate is much more serious than I think Ms. Podlodowski is taking it, because it's not a question of scoring points up here. I mean, we can agree, we can disagree, that's totally fine. You know, even within the same political organization, you can have agreements and disagreements. That's absolutely no problem. But I think if, as people who have some ability, power, because of our positions, if we are going to take the needs of working people seriously, then I think we have to have a serious definition of what getting things done means. So in the context of having the wealthiest country and yet people losing ground like never before, having unprecedented rates of poverty, of inequality, of homelessness, of housing instability. When you look at the lay of the land, people dying simply because they don't have access to healthcare, when you look at all of that, you have to raise the bar. And that's what the movement that's fighting for serious justice is doing. It's raising the bar and saying, what does it mean to get things done? I would say if the state legislature was getting things done, absolutely, first of all, you know, there have been some real progress on eviction reform, but I would give the credit not to the Democratic establishment. I would give the credit to grassroots organizations like the Tenants Union of Washington State and the Washington Community Action Network. But if you had a legislature that was actually in touch and prioritizing the needs of the people, the majority of people who have just backslided in their living standards, then you would have a state legislature that had repealed the ban on rent control. You would have a state legislature that closed all the corporate tax loopholes and immediately make $500, $700 million available every year for public education. You would have a state legislature that would have passed a strong capital gains tax and other big business taxes and taxes on the wealthy to make sure that everybody has access to affordable housing and that we make a serious dent in the homelessness crisis. I think if you have a serious definition of what it actually means to improve people's living standards, then I think the Democratic Party establishment falls far short. Are they different than the Republicans? Absolutely, absolutely. But I don't think this is an audience where we have to explain that the Democrats are not the Republicans. Of course we get that, absolutely. But that is setting the bar really low. Saying you're not like Trump is setting the bar really low. We have to set the bar much higher. And as a matter of fact, the best way to defeat the Trump agenda is to fight for a serious progressive agenda that really mobilizes ordinary people. And I think this is where the key difference comes in. When you say that the Democratic establishment has stood with labor, well, what does that actually mean? It has to mean, when my definition as a rank and file member of the teachers union that represents the community college teachers, my definition of somebody with an elected office standing with labor unions is somebody and a movement that actually pushes back against a larger corporate agenda, but it also has to mean doing the right thing when it is called for, even if it is not the most popular thing. I will say the police union contract vote, it was unfortunate that in a majority people of color council and a supermajority women council, I was the only one who voted no on the police union contract, not because I'm opposed to wages and benefits for police officers, but because that contract represented a rollback in police accountability. And if we're going to stand against racial discrimination and against racial profiling by the police department, we absolutely have to do that. And then the last thing about getting things done. I think our movements have shown how you get things done. The example of winning $15 an hour in Seattle is a perfect example of how you win victories, even though, you know, when I entered the council, it was, if you had done a $15 an hour vote on that day, it was 8 no, 1 yes. And yet, less than 6 months later, we had won a unanimous decision, a yes vote on $15 an hour. And Seattle winning $15 an hour actually set the trend. As a major city winning 15, it set the trend for a national agenda. And now you have presidential candidates like Biden, who has a very poor track record of standing with workers, now saying that he supports 15. But that's the establishment trailing the movement.
So I want to turn to I think a subject which is particularly disturbing in Washington State, which is that you have on the left a rise of a progressive politics and a progressive movement and activism, and on the right, the same forces that are motivating folks on the left are some of the same forces: economic insecurity, inequality, suffering, lack of healthcare, opioid crisis are causing a rise of a white nationalist, very right-wing, often violent movement on the right. Sarah, is there any way to take the anger and upset on the right and bring it to your side?
I absolutely agree.
Also, is this going to, I mean, you know, I fear this is going to end in sorrow for all of us. And I wonder what you guys think of that.
I mean, I think there is absolutely the opportunity to speak to these people. These, as much as it's easy to think of people on the conservative right and people on the far right like that as the other, they really are just people that are poor and hungry and suffering and tired and overworked and underpaid, just like all of us. And when you speak to their pain, when you talk to them like human beings and you pitch them these policies and you're like, you're sick, I want you to have healthcare. You don't have the ability to get to work. I want you to have infrastructure with public transit so you can get to work. To be able to unify around that, to tell people, if you're a politician, saying vote for me because I see you as a person who is houseless and I want you to make enough money to be able to afford a home. The government is meant to be by, of, and for the people, but we have failed so deeply in that mission by concentrating on incrementalism and running to the center that people are suffering and dying, and the right is capitalizing on that anger. They're capitalizing on that pain. Steve Bannon is preying on those people. He is preying on that anger and that fear and that hate, and he is giving them something to point at and say, that's the person who stole this from you. And he's pointing to our neighbors, he's pointing to our brothers, he's pointing to our family members, our sisters, our comrades in arms. He's pointing to people on the same level of us, but he's never pointing up to the people at the top in the billionaire class that are the real people that are causing that suffering and that pain. But because we've worked as within the Democratic Party, as much as the party has tried to work with corporations, that's not the party's job. But we have struggled with this idea of incrementalism, and we run to the center every single time to try and win these votes. We're not winning these votes because we're not digging our heels in on policy that's gonna ebb that pain, that's gonna take that suffering and make it better, that's gonna improve the quality of these people's lives. But we keep saying we will, so of course they don't trust us. Donald Trump is a symptom, he is not a cause. It is pain and suffering and corporate loopholes and constant taxation and putting the burden of society on the backs of the poor and the laborers and the hard workers in our country. And it is making them pay the bill that corporations leave behind, like Amazon paid $0 in corporate income tax. And we have the poor and the working class are the ones that are footing that bill. And that is hurting people, and it is sending people into the arms of another party that is saying, come here, I see your rage and your pain, and I can point to your neighbor and say, that's the person who's causing this, because people need to channel that. But when we start to fight back and we stop this idea of incrementalism, and we actually start to make radical, real changes and fight for radical, real policy, that's what we need, is we need to be radical to fight back against that pain. And I mean, we're all playing this game of tug of war, and the right knows it, and the billionaires know it, and the working class knows it, but every time we reach out to the Democratic Party and we try to have them fight for us, they run to the center. And what happens when you run to the center in a game of tug of war? You lose, and people are tired of losing.
You know, I have to say nobody's running to the center, and I get really offended by the term these people, because I think that I'm the only person on this stage, sorry, who spends time with these people. I spend my time traveling the state of Washington. I am on the road 2 weeks out of every four. I don't see you guys in Chihuahua or Goldendale or all of these other places where people truly are hurting, for whom this idea of making small changes, making differences is what is impacting their lives on a day-to-day basis. Look, as we start to talk about how we work to create legislation again, I am asking for a lot less pontification and a lot more perspiration and a little bit of inspiration in thinking about how you work through these things. This is a big tent in terms of thinking of people and what their needs are. We, as a Democratic Party, have been working hard to work on these issues of the rise of white nationalism and white supremacy. If you have spent any time looking at the newspapers in the last, I don't know, a few months, and Matt Shea, Representative Matt Shea, and going after him, that is what I have singly been doing as State Party Chair of the Washington State Democrats. There is an incredibly disturbing trend in Washington State coming from east to west, but there are pockets, even here in Seattle, of white nationalism and white supremacy that we all need to continue to work on. We need to unite and tell the Republican Party, Matt Shea has to go. It has no place, not just in the Republican Party, but no place in American politics. If you do things like that, if you do work like that, and you talk to these communities, people like Matt Shea and his minions have power in these communities. They run for local office and run these communities. We, as a state party, are doing this work differently than we ever have before. In 2019, there are 3,000 local elections happening in the state of Washington. You know, I think we're sitting here, we probably think Seattle is the most important. It's not. It's all these little city councils, county councils, PUD commissioners, and getting people who don't represent that kind of ideology into office. I will admit it's something that the Democratic Party lost its way on. If you look at the last 10 years of the Democratic Party, and I wasn't running it. I should have been. I wasn't running it. But we screwed up, right? You look at every single legislative race we lost around the country. You look at what happens with gerrymandering. You look at what happens with voter suppression on all of these issues. And you look to see that we had not done the work to tamp down the rise of these right-wing insurgents and people who are domestic terrorists. Let's just call them what they are. So we together need to continue to do this work. I believe that the Democratic Party is the place to do it. I believe that we are the place where we can work on all of these issues. And when it comes to corporate taxation, you are right. We can agree totally on that. There is no reason a corporation in this country should ever be paying $0 in tax. People need to pay their fair share, and they do, but corporations need to pay their fair share as well.
I wanted to first thank you for asking that important question because it is genuinely a threat, the rise of white nationalism and white supremacy. There's no question about that. And I also agree that there are so many instances of gerrymandering and voter suppression. It is not just isolated instances. It is right. It is systematically happening. Right. There's no question about that. I think stepping back, if you can see, if just to think through what is the best way of pushing back and defeating white nationalism and the right-wing agenda as a whole, bigotry as a whole. I think Seattle is an interesting example because obviously I agree Seattle is not the only important place. There's no question about that. But Seattle is an interesting example at this moment in terms of being a sort of a political crucible because the majority of Seattle is very progressive. It's actually well to the left of the people in the mayor's office and on the city council. However, even in a city like this, you've had a rise of right-wing ideas. I don't know how many of you watched the Seattle is Dying video on, film on Como News. If you haven't, it's hard to watch, but it's instructive to see where the thinking is going about homelessness. But it actually comes back to the very important point Sarah made, which is the reason the right-wing ideas are starting to take root, even in the most unlikeliest of places, is because genuine people are looking for an answer as to why is it that these problems have happened so much? Like, why is it that my standards of living have been so bad that I face intergenerational poverty in a state like West Virginia or Oklahoma? Why is it that in a wealthy city like Seattle, you have 14,000 people who are homeless and the homelessness is growing ever more? People are looking for answers, and I think they're correct in identifying that the city's democratic establishment hasn't succeeded in pushing for the bold policies that we need to address the problems of homelessness. It obviously includes rent control. It includes a tax on big businesses like Amazon to fund social housing that is publicly owned affordable housing. It requires a major expansion of social services so that people can actually come out of homelessness. It requires all of this. And there isn't actually majority opposition to this, but you don't have the political will on the city council to do that. The same thing goes for Medicare for All. To actually win it, the question is, how are we going to defeat a $3 trillion insurance and pharmaceutical industry? So I think rather than simply having a discussion about what the Democratic Party can do and not do, I mean, we have disagreements on that. I think, though, this discussion would be incomplete if we didn't talk about the role of social movements, mass movements, and the labor movement. And I would say just one thing specifically. The best way to begin a real fight for Medicare for All, which has 70% support in the nation, is for the nurses' unions and other unions, labor unions that represent hospital and clinical personnel, like the National Nurses United, to actually call for a one-day strike action throughout the nation, you know, just to talk about Medicare for All. But the reason why a strike action has an impact is because it puts a real threat on the power brokers in the industry. Just like Trump's shutdown did not end because of Nancy Pelosi's clever maneuvering in the background. Trump's shutdown ended because the air traffic controllers, the baggage handlers, and all the other workers at the airport decided they were not going to work one more day without pay, and they didn't have an organized sick out, but so many of them called in sick. Sarah Nelson, the president of the Flight Attendants Union, made a very strong statement that there should be a strike against the shutdown. It is workers' action that ended the shutdown. It was workers' action that won $15 an hour. It is workers' actions that can really push back against the right wing and really, as Sarah was saying, unify ordinary people who otherwise would end up becoming fodder for right-wing ideology.
And that's exactly what we're doing. I'm sorry, I gotta push back on one thing here in terms of thinking about how to get health care for everyone in this country. That should be our goal here. Medicare for All is one way to do it, right? But if you were actually to look at the system and take it for somebody who used to run a healthcare organization, you'd probably want to start from Medicaid right now because it doesn't have the donut hole of Medicare, and it actually has the ability to go ahead and negotiate for drug prices. What we need to be focused in on, and I think when people, you look at the polling and everybody's talking about Medicare for All, what people are thinking about is universal health care coverage. We should demand it. We should demand it in a way that gets it through a variety of different places, whether it's dropping the age for Medicare, whether it's upping the number of people on Medicaid, whether it's negotiating for drug prices right now, whether it's looking at how do we break down these industries and see how each and every one of you is covered and not a single person gets bankrupt in this country because of health care issues. But if we keep arguing over this is the one way to do it or this is the name of it, we'll never get it done for the people of this country. We've been working on this forever. Let's stop that fighting.
All right, so we're going to go to your questions now. A lot of great questions here, and there are a whole bunch that all are on the same theme. So I'm going to start with that question. So I'll give Perry, you get the credit for it. But there's probably 20 questions. How do we overcome the combativeness inherent in this conversation and move the state forward? So I'd like each of you to take a crack at that, but pretty quickly. So Tina, you can start, and then move this direction.
Yeah, it'd be great if you stop calling me names like a Democratic establishment. That would be great. Let's sit down and talk to each other. You know what, council member? I've tried to talk to you for years. Make a commitment today. Let's sit down and talk to each other to see how our movements can work together.
Sarah.
I think we need to really expand the umbrella of what it means to be a Democrat. That was something that I ran into in my race. Someone said, "You're not a real Democrat." What does that mean? What does it mean to be a real Democrat? I think it means fighting for working people and having a platform that puts working people first. And I think there's room under the tent and there's room under the umbrella for Democratic Socialists of America. There's room under that umbrella for the Working Families Party, for the Socialist Alternative. There's room and space that exists, but the Democratic Party has to be better about letting those people in instead of shutting them out. And I personally have been to meetings and I've pitched ideas and I've spoken up at meetings when people have shouted me down and shouted me out for not knowing anything. Don't yell at people that are trying to come and join the party. And introduce them to the party. Listen to their ideas. We can talk about how we've had all these other ideas for Medicare for All, but they weren't on the table until we started demanding Medicare for All. And maybe they could have been if we'd had these conversations. So I think as a whole, we as a party really need to be better about opening up that tent, letting these people in and not pushing them out.
Fair point.
Chama, quickly, on that same point.
I think the focus has to be on, because history shows that any social change is won by collective action, not by people sitting at the top. I think the focus has to be on how do we build unified coalitions of ordinary people, the labor movement, renters who are looking for rent control, people who are struggling against homelessness, bringing everybody together at the grassroots in order to fight for what's right and what's bold and what is possible if we build a strong movement. I think the focus on combativeness, at the top is really a distraction from what is actually needed to win things. Because honestly, when you have political debate among elected representatives, that's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. And ultimately, what I would look for, if I wasn't an elected representative, if I was there, what I would look for is exactly what I try to embody through our council office, through my council office, which is elected representatives who are unambiguously loyal to the needs of ordinary people and not selling them out in the name of having cordial relationships with politicians who end up selling you out. So that sometimes gets portrayed as combativeness and divisiveness. So we have to understand that the most divisive thing in our society is the inequality that we face. And if we want to unify people, let's bring people together in unified movements. And we've shown that over and over again through winning $15 an hour and a whole host of renters' rights.
So
I take that to mean we're not having a conversation anytime.
I'm happy to have a conversation anytime. Great. That's not a problem.
Great. Let's do that, and let's make sure that that the public knows that we're having it.
There is no problem with having conversations, mm-hmm. and the fact that we are having a debate doesn't mean that this is not a conversation. Ultimately, though, I am very, very clear. My loyalty does not lie to people at the top. My loyalty lies to the hundreds of thousands of people in Seattle who are struggling for affordable housing and against homelessness.
Again, a question for all of you. The one thing we didn't touch on is the word socialism, which many in the Democratic Party have said this is a toxic word, this is a dangerous word, this word brings up the stigmata of the Soviet Union, it's, you know, Marx, it's Engels. How do you, and Sarah, let's start with you, how do you think progressives can work with that word? Is the word itself a problem or not?
I don't think the word is a problem, the same problem that it used to be. So it used to be I called it the boogeyman hiding under our political beds for a long time, because it was just kind of used as a catch-all phrase for anything that expanded social nets and anything that expanded social stability and social security, we'd get hit with the word socialism. And it's kind of nebulized its way into our political system, but I think that, you know, the reality is that people think about socialism in terms of the Cold War, and at least a lot of people still do. But the younger generation, the millennial generation, Gen Z, we're now the largest voting bloc, and we're now the largest labor force in the United States, but we don't have that same recollection of the Cold War. So that word doesn't have the same stigma to it that it once did, which is why I actually think it's a term you can freely identify with. It's a term you can freely use. It doesn't have that fear tactic anymore. But we remember living through our cultural breakpoint with the economy was the Wall Street crash. It was the housing recession. It was watching our parents lose their homes in foreclosures. It was watching our parents lose their jobs. It was going into a job market that had dried up. It was needing, you know, 8 years of experience for a system that's 3 years old. This is what we went into, and we realized that socialism is something that exists when you're a very wealthy banker and you're allowed to give yourself a bonus with our tax dollars, but it doesn't exist for poor people that need health care. And so I think that false choice sense that people had of I had to choose between a house or my education, we're now realizing that socialism is ingrained in these policies. It's the undercurrent of things like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal. It's how we move forward and how we better our lives. And because we have that, and because we have that idea of socialism in our heads, it's taken a lot of the stigma out of the word. It's not an acidic word anymore.
Dina, do you think the word is dangerous for...
Well, two things, and I started off with this, which is I do think that this the idea that you're espousing of socialism right now from that description really just describes the values of the Democratic Party and what the core values are of the Democratic Party. If you have quotes, as I started with from Harry Truman back in the 50s, saying that people have always thrown this word out, socialism, as a way to try to denigrate what's good for all of the people to make this happen. That no Democrat should be afraid to sort of stand up and say, yeah, you're just trying to scare people with utilizing a particular word. You're not doing what's right for the people of this country when you utilize that. Keep in mind this, though, and this is the nuance to this piece, which is if you look at Washington State and you look at this country, people over the age of 65 disproportionately vote more than people under the age of 25. under the age of 30. So disproportionately, many of those folks who skew slightly more conservative, who might vote for those democratic values, who might be those sort of FDR kind of Democrats, they hear that word socialism, and for them it triggers that past component of it. So we have to do a better job on two things. Number one is speaking out together that this is not something that's scary, that this is really true to those values. And number two is turning people out under the age of 30 to vote. When you disproportionately have far more people over the age of 65 voting, we will not have representation from the people whose future people over 65 are making decisions about, and that's not right.
I want to thank our panelists today, Dama, Sarah, Tina, who were incredibly eloquent. As a non-Washingtonian, I'm jealous of the quality of leadership you seem to have in the state, so congratulations to you all. And I'm sure you can reach them all in certain ways to convey your many other questions to them. So what's the best way to reach each of you?
Go to the Washington State Democrats website. You can click on the email, email me anytime. Or if you want to drive to Eastern Washington, let me know. I go every 2 weeks.
Yeah. Sarah, best way to reach you?
Best way to reach me, I'm on every social media platform, Sarah Smith, the number 4, and then WA. And then we also have a podcast going called the Better Left Podcast, so catch us on Apple Pods.
Sean? Mm-hmm.
You can reach me at my council website. You can just Google me, and it'll show you the city council link where you can contact us, or you can contact me on any social media platform, CM Shama on Twitter.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Crosscut Talks. This week's episode was recorded by Resty Bacall and produced by Sarah Bernard. Audio from the Crosscut Festival was recorded by Seattle Theater Group. You can subscribe to Crosscut Talks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. For more on the Crosscut Talks podcast, go to crosscut.com/talks. And for the latest political, environmental, and culture news from the Pacific Northwest, visit crosscut.com. Crosscut Talks is a product of Cascade Public Media. I'm Mark Bumgarten. We'll be back next week with another episode.